Welcome to the Nonprofit Exchange Podcast, stories by leaders for leaders to help you raise the bar on your own excellence to release the potential inside of you. Now, here's today's podcast. Greetings, everyone. Every Tuesday for the last 8.5 years, I've been right here interviewing a guest, and every one of them has amazing things to share. This is the Nonprofit Exchange, and I'm here with my co-host, Board Chair David Dunworth, and my guest today is Allison Ramsey. She's the president and CEO of, I'm going to let her tell you what it is. So, Allison, we'll talk about your success leading this historic house preservation nonprofit. So, Allison, tell us about yourself, and where is this that you lead?
Well, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you, Hugh and David, for having me on today. So I am the president and CEO of Thomas Jefferson's Poplar Forest, which is located in Lynchburg, kind of on the outskirts of the city of Lynchburg, in very close to Bedford County. Our property actually spans into Bedford County. But this is Thomas Jefferson's retreat home that he inherited this land through his father-in-law. And since his wife, you know, could not own property, the land passed to Jefferson. And he initially comes here in 1781 when he's fleeing the British, who are trying to capture him in Charlottesville. And he stays in an overseer's house. So Poplar Forest, the historic house did not exist at that time. But he stays here in 1781. He writes his only book, which is the Notes on the State of Virginia. It's a tobacco plantation. It's a very profitable tobacco plantation. And as he's inching toward retirement, he starts thinking about building this retreat home. And he, you know, identifies Poplar Forest as the place to build his retreat. So he begins that in 1806. He works on the house up until his last visit in 1823. With obviously the help of enslaved craftsmen who are building the house. But he continues to, that the house is being constructed, and he really never sees it completely finished. But that process is happening through his last visit in 1823. He then leaves the house to his grandson, Francis Epps, who is married at that time. And Francis and his wife live in the house. So upon Jefferson's death in 1826, his grandson inherits the house. They live here for about 2 years. And because the land is so spent from years of tobacco cultivation, which is very hard on the soil and basically depletes the nutrients, they leave and move to Florida. So the house is then in private hands for about 150 years with a few different families, and is radically altered. And, you know, Jefferson builds this house, this very idealistic retreat meant for one man. And it's really not conducive to families who are trying to use it as a country house. And so it goes through a lot of different changes. The floor plan is altered. The roof structure is altered. Windows are bricked up. Doors are bricked up. It's changed from Jefferson's design to a more contemporary design during the federal period. And it's then advertised for sale. In 1983, it is advertised for sale for a commercial use as a bed and breakfast or a restaurant. And a group of citizens get together and say, you know, this can't happen. This is Jefferson's home and we need to rescue it. And they, after three attempts, they're finally successful, and the nonprofit corporation for Jefferson's Poplar Forest is founded. And that begins our story of bringing the house back to its Jefferson era appearance, which I can tell you more about.
Yeah,
that's a terrific encapsulation of what's going on. Poplar Forest, I've been to Lynchburg a couple of times and spent time with Hugh there, but I haven't made it to Poplar Forest. And you say it's overlaps into another county. That's interesting. But tell us about the house in how it was when Jefferson first got there. Do you have any historical information on that, when he first arrives?
So he designs the house, and then, you know, it's constructed. So there was no house when he first arrived. He stayed in an overseer's house in 1781 when he was escaping the British, which is not on land that we currently own. When Jefferson inherits the plantation, it's about 10,000 acres. He sells off, you know, about half of it. About half of it is sold immediately to pay off his father-in-law's debts. By the time Jefferson dies, the land is now only about 1,000 acres. And so when the corporation, the nonprofit that I, you know, work for and head up, when they purchased the house in 1983, they purchased the home and the surrounding. There was 49 acres available. Over time, we have acquired 617 acres, which is basically all that we can, with the exception of maybe a few additional parcels. It's pretty much all we can acquire of the 1,000 acres, but we have been able to capture, you know, most of the and a lot of that land was untouched, so open fields. So we were able, thankfully, due to the vision of our board, the extraordinary vision of our board, able to acquire some of those large parcels and keep them as part of the plantation. So,
okay. Great. Thank you.
Allison, your experience, I mean, you're recently president, you've been part of this for a while, part of this particular, it's a 501c3. Correct. So it's not a government organization, it's a private and privately funded organization. So this is a passion of yours. Why did you choose to be there and do this important work?
Well, thank you for the question. It is a passion of mine. I went to Mary Washington College, now University of Mary Washington College, and majored in historic preservation and art history. And I very distinctly remember a trip to Colonial Williamsburg when I was 13. My parents took us. I grew up on Long Island, so it was a long, long trip down from New York. But took my brother and I to Colonial Williamsburg, and I just remember being fascinated by walking around Colonial Williamsburg, and especially seeing the archaeological excavations that just really struck a chord with me. And so I, in college, you know, pursued historic preservation, and also, you know, was kind of heavily concentrated in the archaeology department, and thinking that I might go to grad school for that. I didn't. I ended up going to University of Virginia in the architecture school for urban and environmental planning. But historic preservation and just preserving that fabric and these places that have so much meaning and are so important to understanding kind of the American experience and our history as Americans has always been a passion of mine. And, you know, I kind of pinch myself every day that I've, you know, if you were to ask me 10 years ago, what would be my dream job? I'm doing it, you know, so I just feel incredibly grateful to be where I am.
But you also have a background in specific areas of fundraising, don't you?
Yes. So after grad school, I worked for Bedford County in the planning department. And then due to my husband's job, we moved out of the area for a little while, and I kind of got into fundraising, and I was working for a fundraising consulting firm. And I really enjoyed that. I enjoyed the variety. We worked with a variety of different nonprofits. So I enjoyed kind of learning about different organizations, and just the work was different every day, but mainly seeing what, you know, volunteers and individuals and what philanthropy can do to help, you know, cause change and create so much positive change. And so I found it very rewarding. And when I came back, when we moved back to Lynchburg, I came back to Poplar Forest in the fundraising field in the development department, and worked as the director of development then for 7 years before becoming the interim CEO, and then eventually the CEO in January of 2020.
David, when you come here, we're going to go there and you'll find this brand new road that she raised a whole bunch of money for. So
is that right?
That's next great. Trip, you're going there.
Okay. Well,
please do. Well, it's really wonderful.
Yeah. I really like going up there because it's such a great, great area and it's new to me. I never really spent a lot of time in the East, but you know, I have worked in around historical homes before, and I know that there's some challenges that occur in the traditional sense because you have to meet the requirements of the historical society. But this home didn't have a historical society when it was built. So what were the challenges specifically that you came across as you're developing this reconstruction plan?
Mm-hmm. Well, fundraising would be, you know, funding it would be the primary challenge. You know, we have been extremely fortunate in that our board of directors never dictated a timeline for this restoration. There was never any pressure to, you know, have it completed by a certain date. And that really gave us a lot of flexibility to do it the right way and to do it, to execute the restoration based on research, you know, careful research. You know, Jefferson, we were very fortunate that because Jefferson was in the White House, he was having to write letters back and forth to the craftsmen to tell them what to do, and they're writing back to him. So we have that documentary evidence, but then, you know, the house burned in 1845. So that was another reason why later owners kind of made such radical changes. So a lot of the physical evidence was completely lost. So there was a lot of kind of architectural archaeology that needed to be done to figure out exactly how Jefferson constructed the house. But yes, I mean, so we were never kind of forced into a timeline, which allowed us to do it correctly, but also to be able to share that entire process with the visitors. So, you know, our director of the architectural restoration was hired in 1989. We just finished the restoration last month. So for 34 years, we've been doing this work while visitors have been touring the house, doing, you know, handcrafting moldings in front of their eyes, you know, talking with them about the whole process. You know, that's been the beauty of it too, is that the craftsmen are there. And so they're able to answer questions and engage with the visitors about, you know, why are you doing that this way? And how did you decide that, you know, that was the type of, you know, molding that should have been used? And yeah, so it's been a very unique and special process in that way. But fundraising is definitely the major challenge because, you know, it's not inexpensive and, you know, that's just a constant effort for us. And, you know, Poplar Forest has suffered from a lack of awareness. We're not on the back of the nickel. We don't have a major, you know, interstate coming through Lynchburg. I mean, we are Jefferson, you know, wanted this to be a retreat. It was very remote and it is, you know, it's hard to find. And, you know, that's one of our primary challenges is kind of making people aware, sharing this place with everyone. So.
Or if you're listening to this podcast or watching this video, you got to come and you got to share it. P-O-P-L-A-R, Poplar Forest, not popular. We're going to make it popular in a different sense. So they're as I've toured it and I get different tour guides, I get different pieces of the story because there's so much to tell.
Right.
And you guys have done a remarkable job, you and your predecessors. Your preservation person has been there, what, 34 years, you said?
34 years. He's retiring in a week. Well-deserved. Hard-earned.
Well, he took it to this point, and that's just miraculous because it... Talking to him, it's been very difficult to find details. And Jefferson's papers aren't in one central place. They're in museums all over. And he had the talk about, as you're doing the restoration, I'm thinking about, well, Jefferson had some very unique qualities. He was very intellectual, very smart. But this was in the classical period. So you think about classical period. But he also had this, shall we say, affinity for symmetry.
I mean, yes.
Everything is balanced. Now, this kind of looks like Monticello, but it's got its own uniqueness to it. So, and also buildings in the University of Virginia and buildings in D.C., there's Thomas Jefferson's mark on those. So what are some of the unique qualities of Jefferson that bless this and challenge this leadership?
Yeah, well, he was definitely very idealistic in his design for Poplar Forest. You know, he was a purist in that this is an octagonal home. So, you know, there's this great letter where Jefferson's he's writing to someone and he says, "I'm sorry, but I find myself that I need to go to Poplar Forest because I have to assist in laying out the foundation because, you know, basically the enslaved craftsman, he can't figure it out and he needs a little help. So I'm leaving Washington. I'm going to go down there and lay it out." But so he designs this, you know, pure octagonal home, but you can't access, can't get to the lower level unless you go outside the house. In his original plan, he adapts this before the house is built, but the original plan is, you know, there's the steps off the front of the house, the north portico, but there's no other steps within the house. So in order to get to the lower level, you have to go outside the house and come all the way around. So he later adds these stair pavilions so you can access the lower level. But also, because it's designed really for one man and it's a very intimate, you know, retreat, you can't get to the dining room from the wing, which is where the kitchen is, without passing through the bedroom, which is on the opposite side of the house where Jefferson's so very symmetrical. So that becomes the granddaughter's bedroom when they start coming with him to Poplar Forest. And later, you know, as they become their teenagers, they want their privacy. The backside of their alcove bed is walled off so that, you know, the enslaved servants can come up and kind of pass behind their bed, but there's a wall now and they can go into the dining room. So they have their privacy. So there are these idiosyncratic things, but, you know, Poplar Forest, really, we think of it as Jefferson's mature architectural genius. You know, he has designed Monticello One, then he goes to France for 5 years and he's influenced by, you know, French culture, art, architecture, and it really elevates his thinking and just, you know, everything that he does. You know, he comes back to America and he's like, you know, just he's been influenced by these, you know, beautiful French, you know, buildings. And so that really brings Poplar Forest to a whole new level. You know, an Englishman who comes to visit says, "This is like nothing I've ever seen before in America. It's like a French chateau. You know, this place has got these beautiful, you know, windows on the parlor, and it feels like you're outside when you're really inside. It's full of light. It's has polished oak floors, which were unheard of at the time." So yeah, we kind of refer to this as, this is where Jefferson really designed, took all of these things that were influencing him throughout his life and synthesized them into one sort of perfect home.
I was visiting friends in Alabama and they had added on to a 1930-ish house. And there were these gorgeous windows off the kitchen and dining area. And they referred to them as Jeffersonian windows. Hmm. So in that room on the back, that the patio that goes out to the back, or the balcony goes over the back, are those, would you call those that type of window? It's just floor to ceiling?
Floor to ceiling windows. Yeah. So, and we, one of the other unique things about Poplar Forest is we don't have any, we do own some original furniture pieces, very few, but we don't display those in the house. We use the house as, it's not climate controlled. Tightly climate controlled. So we use the house as Jefferson would have. So we open the windows on a nice, you know, cool day and use the shutters to control heat and light. But, you know, so we don't have to worry about museum quality, you know, climate control. So, but yeah, so we can raise those windows all the way up and it feels like, you know, it becomes an outdoor room, essentially. It feels like you're in an outdoor room. So We don't let the visitors go out there because we don't have because for safety reasons. But
yeah, do you ever dress up in period outfit when you go to work?
No, never. Never. We actually don't have any living history interpreters that we employ full time. We've been very, very fortunate that the gentleman, Bill Barker, who portrays Thomas Jefferson for Monticello, who was previously at Colonial Williamsburg for decades, comes down and participates in a lot of our events for us. So,
great.
He's tremendous.
What a great story. And a great, I'm definitely going to have to go there the next time I'm up in Hugh's neck of the woods. But, you know, you're a 501c3 and you've been around that organization for a number of years. I'm sure there are other things that you might want to share with other nonprofit leaders, you know, your successes, some of the challenges that you've had. Can you expound a little bit more from your job standpoint or, you know, the nonprofit's standpoint?
Yeah, I'm happy to. You know, challenges, of course, with not alone in this when you are head up a nonprofit, but, you know, we are, I'd love to have several more staff members. You know, I feel like we're constantly, you know, jumping from one thing to the next and understaffed and under-resourced, and that we can, you know, certainly use some more funding to make things happen. But that's, you know, that's, I hope that with greater visibility and raising our awareness and getting more people involved, that some of those things will, you know, that will improve over time. And certainly we just completed a very successful capital campaign to build our entrance road. We've completed the restoration. We've installed a couple new exhibits. So we've got great momentum, but you know, my goal really in this role is we have spent, you know, 40 years rescuing, you know, restoring this place. And I want to make sure that it is here forever, you know, and so I don't want us to be struggling in 10 years to try to meet the budget. So what I really want to do is grow our endowment and get this place on, you know, very, very solid footing so that, you know, there's no question that, you know, Papa Force will always be here and that the staff doesn't have to struggle so much to, you know, make ends meet. You know, visitation ebbs and flows over time. Certainly the pandemic was a tough hit for a lot of nonprofits, and especially, you know, theaters, house museums, anywhere that people were not able to visit. So, that's one of my goals, is just to make sure that Papa Force is solid for the future. So, but you know, some things I've learned, our staff is amazing. We have just a super committed group of staff members and board members. And, you know, I would not be successful without them. You know, my staff is so committed. I mean, they're so dedicated to this place. Everybody is working so hard all the time. You know, we're here on, a lot of us have to work weekends, you know, working it in the evenings to get things done. I mean, it is definitely a team effort and everybody's all in, you know, they're supremely committed. I'm, you know, very busy every day. I don't micromanage them. I don't have to, you know, I know that they are doing their job and they're doing what needs to be done. And that's a gift because, you know, there's really no time to micromanage people. So, and I try to, you know, there were definitely a lot of times, especially in the beginning of the pandemic where, you know, it was, we didn't know what was coming next, you know, I mean, you just really didn't know what was around the corner, but I always tried to kind of be calm and just take it day by day and not make any rash decisions. You know, I remember having a conversation with our CFO at the time about, you know, do we need to furlough staff members? Do we need to cut positions? And I was just, I'm not doing that. You know, I am not going to do that until, you know, till it becomes, you know, until I know that I have to. And so, so there were a lot of lessons during that time. I'm just try to keep an open door too for the staff and know that I'm always here to, you know, talk to them about their concerns. I think that wasn't always the case in the past, you know, and that's really important. I mean, I trust them. I want them to trust me and know that, you know, we are all in this together. So.
All really important themes that, you know, your best resources are around you, right. Whether a formal team or an informal team, there's both.
Yeah.
Those in the payroll and those we call the big V volunteer people, but they're actually servant leaders if we allow them to be. So the website is Poplar, P-O-P-L-A-R, Forest, P-O-P-L-A-R, Forest.org. So when they go to your website, what will they find, Allison?
Well, thank you for pulling that up and for sharing it. So yes, this is our homepage. And then if you click through the visit, you can see all the details about how to plan a visit, whether you're coming by yourself or with a group tour. You can see our events. We have a lot of events coming up this summer. If you kind of explore deeper, there's our museum shop. We have a great museum shop and a wonderful selection of books. Then we have the Learn tab. There's a page on the Parkway too, which is our new entrance road and a trail system. So we have a lot of information on the website where you can learn about Jefferson, you can learn about the restoration, about archaeological excavations and the landscape restoration, which we have been very fortunate to have the support of the Garden Club of Virginia to help restore the designed landscape. We have more work to do in that regard, but the landscape in front of the house has been fully restored, which was another really important aspect of Jefferson's design, which was lost in later generations. So, but we have ways to support us on that. You can read about the board and the staff. We have a new strategic plan that we adopted in September. That's on there too. And then, yeah, just full of information. So,
and there's a lot to learn in the 10 years that my wife and I've been coming. We've seen these things morph, and it's just really good to see this much passion going onto this resource. So what's a parting thought you want to share with those nonprofit leaders who are out there, might be discouraged, don't know where to go, don't know what to do next? What kind of encouragement would you give them?
Yeah. Well, stay the course because good things will happen. You know, we have had some tremendous, you know, successes and surprises in our history. I feel like there's, you know, some of these projects that were daunting, you know, we've built some really solid relationships with our donors that have helped us to achieve things that never, you know, we never thought would have been possible. You know, from my fundraising hat, I would say, you know, stewarding your donors and staying in touch with them is so, so important. And, you know, just a few phone calls a week, if you can find the time just to update people on what you're doing and how they've helped you make a difference, is so important. And just taking care of the staff. I mean, we had an opportunity this year to reward the staff with, we've never been able to do like quality of life raises every year for our staff. You know, that's just not something that we've been able to do, but with some position changes that happened this year, we were able to provide, you know, raises, more than just a quality of life raise for the staff. And you know, I was just really glad that we were able to do that, because I want to keep everybody happy and here, and I don't want them going anywhere. So just, you know, reward the staff. And the years that we couldn't do that, to give raises, and what we would do is like a couple of raises each year, we would try to give extra time. So like an extra day around the holidays that they could use, that, you know, was so, but, you know, reward your staff. And also, finding good mentors, people who you can contact and reach out to if you know, there's something that I really needed some guidance on, but maybe couldn't go to, you know, the board about it. Having those people that are, you know, that will give you sound advice that you can go to, that has really been very beneficial for me. So, especially being, you know, a new CEO. So,
David, those are some of the themes that we focus on in Center Vision Leadership Foundation, aren't they?
Absolutely. I was just thinking the same thing. You're speaking to the choir. We talk about that kind of stuff.
Good. Actually,
reinforcing the very important themes of nonprofit leadership. So, Allison, thank you so much for being our guest on the Nonprofit Exchange today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. And I encourage everyone to visit our website and come see us in person.
I'm looking forward to it.
Good.
Thank you for watching The Nonprofit Exchange.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.